From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd in for Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Stormy Daniels' highly anticipated interview with Anderson Cooper on 60 Minutes was the highest rated episode since an interview with Barack and Michelle Obama 10 years ago. And last night, the adult film star gave more details about the 2006 affair she says she had with Donald Trump.
He's like, wow, you are special. You remind me of my daughter. He's like, you're smart, beautiful, and a woman to be reckoned with. I like you.
She also said she was physically threatened to keep quiet. President Trump denies the affair, so does his lawyer Michael Cohen. But 11 days before the 2016 presidential election, Cohen paid Daniels $130,000 and asked her to sign a non-disclosure agreement. Washington Post reporter Emma Brown is here. Emma, this story is salacious. Stormy Daniels agrees with people who say she's not a victim. It was consensual. But tell us what we learned about, for instance, that she signed a statement at one point denying an affair.
Right. Shortly after the Wall Street Journal broke the story about the payment to her, she did sign a statement denying that the affair occurred. And she said she did that because she was under pressure from her lawyer at the time and business manager at the time, who she did not name. But she said they were telling her not that there was a physical threat against her, but that there could be all kinds of other implications for her. And she said, you know, they told me basically that they could make my life hell. And by they, Anderson Cooper followed up and he said, well, who's they? And she said, well, I assume it's Michael Cohen.
So that was about, you know, threats of harassing her. But then there was also what she claims is a physical threat. Let's listen.
I was in a parking lot going to a fitness class with my infant daughter. I was taking, you know, the seats facing backwards in the back seat, diaper bag, you know, getting all the stuff out. And a guy walked up on me and said to me, leave Trump alone, forget the story. And then he leaned around and looked at my daughter and said, a beautiful little girl, it'd be a shame if something happened to her mom. And then he was gone.
Was that one of the most shocking portions of the interview for you? And what's been the response to it?
That was absolutely one of the newsiest parts of this interview. I mean, Stormy Daniels' lawyer, Michael Avenatti, has been on cable news quite a bit in the last couple weeks saying, you know, that his client had faced threats and that we would hear details on 60 Minutes. So this was totally new. Mm-hmm. And she said that this experience in the Las Vegas parking lot really scared her and has sort of colored her perception of this whole thing over the last, well, that was 2011, so mm-hmm. 7 years ago. Cohen's lawyer responded last night with a letter to Stormy Daniels and her lawyer, a cease and desist letter saying, what you're saying is not true about my client, Michael Cohen. You're libeling him. Stop it.
Yeah. But she never said it was him, you know, making that threat. Look, the other important part of the story is the payment, $130,000, and a question of whether it violated federal campaign finance laws. Do we know any more about that? And explain why that would be.
So the $130,000 payment by Michael Cohen to Stormy Daniels, Cohen has acknowledged making that payment, and he has said that he was not reimbursed by anyone. That far exceeds the individual gift limit for a campaign donation. And so the argument that the government watchdog group, Common Cause, and others have made is that this payment was meant to influence the election. It was meant to protect Trump's reputation at a time when he was really under fire for his relationships with women in the aftermath of the Access Hollywood tape. And so it was meant to influence the election and therefore a campaign donation, an in-kind campaign donation. So Common Cause has made that complaint to the Federal Election Commission and also to the Department of Justice, and that complaint is pending.
So we see what happens there. And what happens to all of these women? Stormy Daniels speaking last night, arguing that since Cohen admitted paying her $130,000 and Trump never signed the non-disclosure agreement deal, that it is not valid. She's free to talk. You had Karen McDougal a couple days before, the former Playboy centerfold, who is suing to break free of her confidentiality agreement but is out talking. Last week, a judge decided to let a lawsuit from the former Apprentice contestant Summer Zervos go ahead. What happens with all of these?
Well, it's become this incredible storyline that is running alongside everything else that's happening in the Trump White House. And I think there are much bigger questions here than just about whether or not Trump had sex with these women more than a decade ago. There are these questions about campaign finance law violations or potential campaign finance law violations, questions about the intimidation. And I just think that this is going to be a story now that the White House will have to be dealing with for some time.
Yeah. Emma Brown, investigative reporter with The Washington Post. Emma, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, let's go to Egypt now, where there is very little doubt about who is going to win this week's presidential election. Today is the first of 3 days of voting, and incumbent Abdel Fattah el-Sisi has only one opponent, a little-known candidate who had once said that he actually supports President Sisi. Joining us now is NPR's Jane Arraf. She's in Cairo. And Jane, tell us what's happening today. Are people voting even though they basically know what the results are going to be?
They are definitely voting because it's being billed as kind of a patriotic duty. And that was the message that I got from the people I spoke with this morning. One of them was a retired engineer named Sameh Sultan. And he told me that there was a really basic reason he was voting. It was his duty.
I'm Egyptian. And it's simple. Egyptian, real Egyptian, means there is a vote. Voted. Why not?
Did you have any concerns that there weren't more candidates, or you felt it was okay?
No, it's okay. And I hope the whole world knows that we are okay.
So obviously it's not okay for everyone because there were other candidates who faced a lot of problems and they withdrew their candidacy. Some of them were actually arrested. That's how difficult it was to actually run. But that little comment, I think, is quite revealing because it also tells us that one of the points of this election really is to show the world that Egypt is having elections.
Hmm. And as you've said, Sisi has stifled any meaningful opposition. He has been known to even jail journalists. So, I mean, there are some issues going on there. And yet he still has supporters. Why is that?
There are, as you point out, a lot of restrictions. In many ways, when you talk to people, this country is more repressive than it was even under the era of Hosni Mubarak, who was toppled in a peaceful coup in the Arab Spring. There's a state of emergency that's been declared after attacks by ISIS. That state of emergency allows detention without charge. There are all sorts of people who have been rounded up. The crackdown on the media has included banning more than 93 news websites, and it's really very difficult for people to speak openly. Having said that, he still does have a lot of support because there are some things that a lot of Egyptians care more about, and they care about stability, they care about security. Mm. Some of them aren't that fussed about human rights and freedom of expression and all those other things.
Well, you had mentioned security, and Sisi had promised when he took office that he would boost security, that he would crack down on terrorism. You've referenced some of the attacks that the country has seen over the last year or so. How is he explaining that to voters? I mean, is he saying that he's been successful at enhancing security there?
He has, in a sense. He is billing himself as the guy who can put this country back together, the one who will continue to fight for stability. Reminding Egyptians that, in his words, Egypt has a lot of enemies. So in many ways, this is seen as almost as an existential battle, that it's the survival of Egypt that's at stake here. So that's what he uses to justify a lot of these measures.
This election reminds me a lot of what we just saw in Russia. Vladimir Putin didn't have any opposition to speak of, really. He got 77% of the vote. Does Sisi need something similar to happen here? Does he need a lot of people to come to the polls? And does he need to win by a big majority?
In the last election that he ran in, and Sisi is the former military general, we'll recall, who led a military coup after Egypt's first democratically elected leader. He was toppled after protests against his Muslim Brotherhood government. So Sisi ran a year after that, and in those elections, he got almost 97% of the vote. Hmm. So that 77% in Russia isn't looking that good. That one also had only two candidates, and almost half of eligible voters came out. So it's going to be a little bit embarrassing if he doesn't achieve those incredible levels of support.
Where does this leave people in Egypt who had hopes for democracy after the Arab Spring 7 years ago?
That's a great question. And those are the people who are not out there talking about how happy they are to be voting, because in many ways they are launching a silent protest by boycotting this vote. And silent because there has been an actual movement to try to organize a boycott of the vote. Those people have been portrayed as traitors. So it's quite dangerous these days to actually openly say that you're against Sisi or against this process. But there are an awful lot of particularly young people who thought that the Arab Spring would bring in openness and human rights and inclusiveness and opportunity, and it's done nothing of the sort. And there are a lot of people who are very depressed about that.
That's NPR's Jane Aref on day one of voting in Egypt. Jane, thank you so much.
Thank you.
St. George, Utah is now the fastest growing metropolitan area in the country, according to the U.S. Census Bureau. The city in Washington County, Utah is tucked into the southwest corner of the state. The area's population grew by about 4% last year. But not all of Utah is thriving. Other areas lost population at some of the fastest rates in the country. So what's going on? Pam Perlick is director of demographic research at the University of Utah's Gardner Policy Institute. And Pam, why don't you start by telling us a little bit more about St. George, Utah, the place?
I've heard it referred to as sort of the Palm Springs of Utah. It has a climate that is just superb for wintertime, especially. It's within a stone's throw of Zion National Park. You get towering red rock and beautiful canyons, and with that low humidity and beautiful desert environment, it has a really high quality of life. Housing is still reasonable as far as the cost of housing. It's a small enough place that you don't feel like you're overwhelmed in a large city.
Is that the reason why it is the fastest growing metro area in the United States? All those reasons?
Yes. Now, we were accustomed to seeing the St. George metro area designated as among the fastest growing metro areas up until the financial crisis hit. That area of the state was hit with more overbuilding. It was much more like the housing markets got in Vegas, or if you look down into the Phoenix area. So it was part of that growth dynamic that led up to the speculative financial bubble that then there was the crash and the Great Recession.
Yeah.
2010 were the depths of the recession. And then as we started digging out of that, migration began to increase again. But what we've seen, particularly in the last 3 years, is a lot of the migration patterns and flows that we saw pre-Great Recession are beginning to reestablish themselves, albeit at a slower pace, both relatively and absolutely.
So 165,000 people live there approximately now, and we're seeing that 86% of the growth last year came from people moving in from other places. Now, that's important, isn't it?
That's very important because in Utah in general, we're kind of a 65% natural increase, 35% net in migration. But for the really fast growing areas of the state, net migration really plays a major role in this set of estimates. And the place that stands out the very most there is the Washington County area.
And who are the people moving in?
Well, there are a variety of people moving in, but it is disproportionately a retirement destination. So you're seeing what they're calling the young elderly. Those are people who are able to leave the labor market, say 55 years old or so, moving there with independent income and wealth. But then you're also seeing the streams of people who are already old enough to receive Medicare, that's showing up in the Medicare records. We also have some industry establishing itself there. Tourism is a mainstay of the Washington County economy. It's a big second home, vacation home community. That's part of the challenge of estimating the population there and understanding how much infrastructure and services are needed, because on any given night, 20% of the occupied housing units are occupied by people who are not even showing up in the numbers that we're talking about.
Well,
right
you
now.
Make a you make a good point. When a city that's the size of St. George, it's growing steadily, but it's got to put pressure on things like the housing market, the sewer lines, the roads, that sort of thing. Are they keeping
and
up?
And water. Yeah. Water is the big constraint down there. And in our state projections, we see that Washington County is going to triple in size in the next 50 years, you know, surpassing 500,000 people. That really will fundamentally change the character of the place and put enormous pressure on infrastructure.
Well, this is also a tale of two counties in Utah, because you have Uinta County there in the eastern part of the state up by Wyoming. It is losing population at one of the fastest clips in the country. What's going on there?
We have some areas of the state that are still tied to the very classic Western economies. So if you look at Carbon and Emery County, also Uinta County, these are places that are dependent on oil and gas and also coal mining. And so they are exposed to the booms and busts of those industries. At the same time, those industries have become more and more capital intensive, meaning they require less labor. So when the booms come, you know, they're richly rewarded. And then when the busts come, people have to leave.
So is there a lesson to be learned then between these two different counties in Utah, one that is losing people and one that is growing so fast? I mean, does it say something about the state's economy?
It does. And the one part of the state that we've not talked about is, of course, where 80% of the population lives, and that is in the Wasatch Front area.
In the Salt Lake
and
area.
Yes, the greater Salt Lake area. And Provo-Orem Metro, this is just to the south of Salt Lake, but connected to Salt Lake, you know, economically, through transportation, through all other connections. Let's not forget that it was also in the top 10 for metropolitan area growth, and it's number 8, and it's a much bigger place. So the real sort of globally connected metropolitan area to the north is becoming much more diversified, much more globally integrated. So that's the big driver of the Utah economy. St. George has a lot of connections to this area because of the second homes, because of the people who leave the Wasatch Front to retire. We look out into the rural areas, the ones that are still tied to those classic Western economies, mining and oil and gas. They are not connected in that way. They are just, you know, nakedly exposed to the brute forces of global markets and global competition and the booms and busts of those industries.
And that is a snapshot of rural America writ large.
Yes.
Pam Perlick is Director of Demographic Research at the University of Utah's Gardner Policy Institute. Pam, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Well, to questions of faith now in this Holy Week for many. Church youth groups often take up issues, but at the First Baptist Church in Nashville, young people are debating the very relevance of the Bible in a scientific and technological age. Natasha Sinyanovich from member station WPLN reports.
Tim Wildsmith isn't your typical Southern Baptist youth pastor.
You guys ready for Signs of Faith?
Yeah.
We started this series last year. It was awesome.
The tattooed former musician wants to bridge what he sees as an artificial gap.
Historically, the church is trying to tend to draw this hard line between science and faith. It said, you either believe that God created everything and that science is totally fake or not. There's this kind of false opposition between the two.
Wildsmith says one major reason young people who live and breathe science and technology are leaving Southern Baptist churches nowadays is
because they wonder if what the church is offering them through faith is relevant to our current context in our culture.
So Wildsmith has a Vanderbilt University Divinity School student with a physics degree spend several weeks discussing the importance of science and the Bible with the middle and high schoolers in the group. For their first activity, the kids are given statements like prayer can help heal sick people, or global warming is likely to cause major changes on Earth. They have to place them under categories such as science and faith agree or disagree, or scientists have varying views, and so on. That leads to an intense discussion between senior Justin Jordan Lake and another student on deferring to experts in scientific debates.
The second someone says, I have a degree in climate science, and I don't, that's where the conversation ends. That's where I sit there and I listen to them, and I don't talk about my opinion.
Jordan Lake says when he was little, he could have passed a lie detector test that the creation story was real. Not anymore. But he also says he's a stronger Christian now, precisely because he's not afraid to question what he's told.
There were things that I thought and believed, and as they kind of slowly unraveled, it wasn't like they unraveled to a place where I was an atheist. They unraveled to a place where I wanted to find out more.
18-year-old Shannon Pickerell also loves the class. The daughter of lawyers wishes these conversations and mediations were taking place not just in other churches, but in politics, too.
As soon as we get so polarized that we reject, not just reject the ideas of other people, but reject the people themselves, I mean, people from the church excluding scientists or vice versa or anything, I think that's when the danger comes in, because then we're not, we can't progress as a people, as an American society.
And how did American society, one of the most technologically advanced in the world, get to the point where science is even considered controversial or partisan? Volney Gay, a professor of religious studies at Vanderbilt University, traces the moral rift to the rise of Darwinism in the late 19th century. But he cites attorney and three-time presidential hopeful William Jennings Bryan as stirring up the political divide with the so-called Scopes Monkey Trial of 1925. Gay says U.S. lawmakers followed suit, finding that science and evolution could unite voters who otherwise had little else in common.
It suited politicians and large-scale political parties to propose to their followers that their faith, their very personal, private faith, was under attack.
Gay says that exploiting that perceived threat of scientists trying to discredit faith intensified in the 1970s and 80s as religious fundamentalism was rising in America. But he's quick to point out there's no reason science and faith can't coexist. Gay says science is tentative, constantly changing. It can be wrong, while faith is immediate, powerful, more stable.
It's something I feel and know in my own experience. Ethics would be the same. When we have an ethical decision, we don't look for empirical support. We look inside.
Gay is impressed that the First Baptist Church is addressing head-on what he calls the science and religion debacle, especially when most young people have no problem reconciling the two. Indeed, Justin Jordan Lake, the high school senior, says scientific knowledge about something like the environment only adds to faith.
The amount of devotion that you put to praying and stuff, why would you not devote that to making God happy that you're taking care of what he created for you? You know, that's what I think. That's just what I've never really, it's never clicked in my mind.
That, says youth minister Tim Wildsmith, is exactly the kind of thinking that the class is meant to inspire. For Here and Now, I'm Natasha Sinjanovic in Nashville.
Hi, I'm Guy Raz.
And I'm Mindy Thomas.
And together, we bring you Wow in the World,
NPR's podcast for families.
Every week, we explore wild and new scientific discoveries.
We also ride a bird. Find Wow in the World on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.
The U.S. is expelling dozens of Russian diplomats and will close the Russian consulate in Seattle in response to Moscow's alleged involvement in the poisoning of an ex-spy and his daughter in Britain earlier this month. Today, word of those American penalties were echoed by announcements in European capitals across the continent. Russia has denied responsibility for what the U.K. describes as the attempted murder of Sergei Skripal and his daughter Yulia in Salisbury in southern England on March 4th. They are still hospitalized, still unconscious. NPR's national security correspondent Greg Myrie is here. Greg, so who are these people being expelled? Is it thought that they're not diplomats but spies?
Well, that's what the Trump administration is saying. And there's certainly the presumption that many of the Russian diplomats coming here are, in fact, intelligence people. The U.S. monitors them, keeps an eye on them, certainly has a list. And I'm sure these are the people identified as intelligence agents are being kicked out. It is a huge number. And there may be some ordinary diplomats in that group as well. We don't know for sure.
Yeah, something like 60. But why close the Russian consulate in Seattle in particular?
The reason they're giving is that it's near the Boeing manufacturing plant and near a submarine base, but also just, I think, a way to send part of a pretty strong message. In fact, the Trump administration last summer also closed the Russian consulate in San Francisco, so now both of the Russian consulates on the West Coast are being closed down.
Yeah. Well, Russia's embassy in Washington tweeted out, you know, to its followers, vote for which U.S. consulate should be closed, St. Petersburg. Vladivostok. I mean, they obviously are thinking there will be some retaliation. But how serious is this? Put this in context.
In diplomatic terms, it is pretty serious. Maybe in the slightly broader context, nobody's threatening military maneuvers or security actions. But it's part of this one additional element of friction with obviously the 2016 election, this diplomatic issue over the poisoning of a former spy, the situation in Syria where Russia and the U.S. are on opposite sides of that war. The U.S. commander in Afghanistan said Russia is helping the Taliban. So it adds one more element to a very fraught relationship.
Well, the investigation of Russian involvement in the U.S. election, in the British Brexit election. Less than a week ago, President Trump called Vladimir Putin and congratulated him for winning with air quotes, the Russian election, despite the leaked memo that said he was not to congratulate him. And now we have this, you know, expelling of diplomats today. Is it seen as connected, or is this something that the White House, you know, had to go along with, you know, countries around the world?
I think probably the driving force was to present a unified effort between the United States and many of its European allies, Germany, Britain, and others. So I think that's probably more the driving force. I'm not sure it was really to counter that congratulatory call last week. I'd see it more in that light.
Yeah. NPR National Security Correspondent Greg Myrie. There's going to be a lot of moving vans pulling up to homes in Washington, D.C. in particular, Seattle. Greg, thank you.
My pleasure, Robin.
Charlottesville, Virginia, was one of a number of cities that held a March for Our Lives rally in favor of gun control this past Saturday. Of course, Charlottesville was also where a protest by neo-Nazis last year turned deadly. Reports have now concluded that police and the city were ill-equipped to respond. Well, our next guest has some suggestions for cities and for all of us in these partisan times. He once headed the federal agency that's charged with helping heal social divisions and broker compromise. It's the Community Relations Service. It's within the Department of Justice. And in contrast with court-ordered solutions by other arms of the Justice Department, the Community Relations Service doesn't come to a city unless officials want it there. President Trump's latest budget proposal calls for it to be transferred within the DOJ. Grand Lum says that would gut it. He was the director of the Community Relations Service from 2012 to 16. He's now director of the Divided Community Project at Ohio State University. Grand, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And this agency, the Community Relations Service, created in 1964 by President Johnson. It helped mediate the civil rights protests in Selma. People on the agency walked with protesters. It brokered peace in Boston during desegregation. So it goes into the communities, literally, as it says, and tries to bring sides together or at least hold off violence. Just address the proposal to transfer it to the Civil Rights Division. What's the problem with that?
I think it would be a tragedy if that happened. It's a unique agency. It's specifically to mediate and conciliate in communities across this country, specifically on racial disputes. And if we got rid of that, it would mean a tremendous loss.
Well, the Trump administration isn't talking about getting rid of the agency. It's talking about moving it within the Department of Justice to the Civil Rights Division. And we understand that your concern about that is that it gets it closer to prosecutors.
Exactly. So the Civil Rights Division has a very specific course of action. You know, their job is to prosecute. For the Community Relations Service, as it was created by the 1964 Civil Rights Act, does no litigation, does no prosecution, does not do any interrogation. So what's important is that for parties to be willing to come to the table, they need to be comfortable that whatever is said is held confidential, and that they are not at any potential danger of being prosecuted here. So moving it, the function, to the Civil Rights Division would effectively end its function.
All right. Well, concern about that. But let's talk about why, about past successes. You were the director in 2012 when George Zimmerman shot and killed Trayvon Martin. That helped spark the Black Lives Matter movement. We remember how fraught that moment was. Your people, you were on the ground in Sanford, Florida, and you urged the mayor there to talk to protesters at a rally. He didn't want to do this. What did you tell him?
Mayor Jeff Triplett, Sanford's a very small community. They were not accustomed to having thousands of protesters coming to their city. And what he learned very quickly was that the Community Relations Service, we've been working with law enforcement, with protesters all around the country. And he listened to our advice. He was reluctant. He made a decision that it made sense, and he called it a huge turning point in terms of rebuilding community trust. There were dozens of protests, but there was not a single arrest, not a single glass bottle thrown. We were able to have both free speech and we were able to maintain public safety.
Right. And he has since said that this was, you know, he didn't want to do it, but it was something that obviously meant a lot to the community. I mean, we are in such a divided, fractious, it seems like impossible to bridge time right now. These people on the ground, what do they say to people on the different sides of these issues? What skills do they bring?
I think one thing you really want to do is just to listen. Secondly, these wonderful Community Relations Service conciliators and mediators, they know the numerous stakeholders here. One other thing that Community Relations Service was helpful to Sanford was just bringing the parties to the table earlier than they would have otherwise to begin talking about what were the rules of engagement. Sanford did a really amazing job, their city manager, their mayor, even welcoming the protesters, even making it easier for them. Here's where to park. Here's how to handle the overflow. So that, I think, also made a big difference. The other thing was being the convening party of black and white pastors in the Sanford area, working with them to help keep the peace in Sanford. Throughout the trial, Community Relations Service worked with them and brought them to the trial each and every day so that when those pastors returned to their congregations, they were reducing the rumors. Mm. They were saying, here's what's going on. And it really helped bring the community together as well.
Well, there's even more rumors now. Now you have this divide inflamed by social media. You point to statistics from Pew Research that American political identities are increasingly turning into personal identities, both sides viewing the others as extremists. There's a 25-year high in people not wanting an immediate family member to marry someone from the opposing political party. In the 1950s, only 10% of voters had negative feelings for people in the opposing party. Now it's at 90%. How do you bring those sides together?
Bring residents together. There are groups like Better Angels, Sustained Dialogue, where they bring folks together. I also think we need to bring together folks who are the reasonable advocates at the policy level.
We just saw that play out. Maine's Republican Senator Susan Collins, who brought together a group of lawmakers to have negotiations to end a government shutdown back in January. She used a talking stick. What was that? By the way, you pass it around the room and whoever has it gets to talk?
Yes, it's a classic tool used in mediation, used in talk circles. Susan Collins, of course, is a moderate senator from Maine, and her office is actually known as the Switzerland of the Senate. The rule when you use a talking stick is whoever holds the stick gets to speak, which forces senators who do not often like to not talk to actually pause and allow the person with the stick to speak. It actually helped end the government shutdown.
Well, as we approach the Easter or the Passover table, how else can we get through that meal?
I think what's important is to actually listen. I've talked about listening as a superpower. Terrence Cunningham, who is the president of the International Association of Chiefs of Police, he apologized for the mistreatment of minorities. That's the type of thing that I think needs to happen.
Well, I'm wondering, too, if when it comes to the gun debate, as you say, really listening, and what I hear over and over is people saying, maybe we don't need those assault-style rifles, but I don't want anyone taking my guns away. Well, none of the plans call for anyone's guns to be taken away. And so if maybe somehow fears can be addressed.
I think that's right, Robin. The ownership of a gun is an emotional and a personal identity, it's hard to come to agreements when there's that sort of potential loss of identity. When you can help people move beyond that, then you can create movement because there is shared interest, right? Mm-hmm. We do know that 96% of people want universal background checks. We do know that 75% of people are in favor of a 30-day waiting period.
You've written about this in a Huffington Post column, you know, advice for people trying to get through this impasse. You say disconnect the reaction from the person, lower your boiling point, and tell the third story. What do you mean by that?
It's the ability to focus first on what matters, right? Okay, I want to hear your story. I want to have my story. But what's a story that we can both agree to? In gun control, we want to prevent tragedies. That's the third story.
You work now at the Divided Community Project, studying the effect of social media. What are you seeing?
We can see all the negative. There are many examples of communities who use social media to connect. For example, the Knoxville Police Department, they have one of the most visited Facebook accounts. They're engaging with their community. Seattle, it's very much used as in a two-way fashion to hear feedback. And one thing we've been talking to communities across the country about is you've got to build trust before the dividing event, right? And so Columbus, Ohio is one of the pilot sites, and they've been very focused on building relationships with the mosque, with the Somalian community, with the immigrant community here, before something bad happens. And we work with some of the folks in the Orlando, Central Florida area in terms of the tragedy at the Pulse nightclub. The fact that lesbian, gay, transgender were in relationship with Mayor Buddy Dyer's staff, that made a difference when something like the Pulse tragedy happens.
That's Gren Lum, director of the Divided Community Project at Ohio State University. A lot of people going out to get a talking stick. Gren, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me, Robin.
And the week got off to another bumpy start for Facebook. Shares in the social media company plunged this morning after the Federal Trade Commission confirmed it's investigating how the company deals with customer data. The investigation follows the news that data from 50 million users got into the hands of the British consulting firm Cambridge Analytica. And now there's another controversy. Over the weekend, some users found out Facebook has been collecting text message and phone call data from their Android devices. Joining us now is Derek Thompson. He's senior editor at The Atlantic. Derek, it's nice to have you back.
Good to be here. Thank you.
So here we are talking about Facebook again. What's the latest controversy over this text message and phone data?
So following the Cambridge Analytica scandal, people started downloading the data that Facebook had on them. They started clicking into their Facebook accounts and downloading the full data files to see exactly what Facebook could see. And one man who did this, a man named Dylan McKay from Wellington City, New Zealand, he downloaded his data and he found that Facebook had information on his calls with his partner's mother.
Hmm.
So with a little bit more spelunking in the caves of Facebook data, it turns out that Facebook has been getting access to contacts, to text data, to call history, maybe even to call times on Android phones specifically. This doesn't seem to be happening on Apple phones. It seems to be Android, that is Google phones, explicitly or exclusively, I should say.
And why? What are they doing with that data?
Yeah, well, it seems that Facebook was getting this data legally, and they were getting it to make their product better. To make the product better, you could say, for users so that they could distinguish between weak ties, close ties, best friends, business contacts. That could help them sort the newsfeed better. It could help them sort the friendships better. And then you could also argue, as we saw in the Cambridge Analytica scandal, that this is also about advertising, that this is about Facebook giving away data about users to potential advertisers so that advertisers can target particular demographics more effectively on Facebook than they can in other media, like even Google or certainly maybe print or radio or television. And this, after all, was Facebook's whole business model. This was their existential case for being. It was the idea that in no other place in the world could advertisers know with more granular detail who they were reaching. And so in many ways, these tiny scandals that which are sort of snowballing and become big scandals, scandals, they're not just about one data policy or one contract policy. They really go to the heart of what Facebook is, why it's valuable, and why people use it.
So maybe more trouble here for Facebook to try to work out. CEO Mark Zuckerberg took out apology ads in several newspapers this weekend because of the Cambridge Analytica scandal, nothing to do with this one that we've just been talking about. Are people satisfied that Facebook is trying to take meaningful steps to stop something like this from happening again, although it seems to be happening again?
It happens again and again and again. Yeah, I'll talk to you next week about the next scandal. It's really it's hard to say, are people satisfied? Because Facebook has hundreds of millions, if not billions, of users. It has potentially it itself is a kind of virtual nation state. And you can sort of sort this virtual nation state into three categories. There are people who aren't following the scandal. They simply don't know that it exists, number one. Number two, there are people who are following the scandal but don't really care. Maybe they say, you know what? I knew Facebook was doing stuff like this. I knew that when you're not paying for the product, you are the product. And Facebook, like all sorts of other apps and digital services, had a bunch of data on me and my online activity. And I don't really care. I don't look at the contract language. It's just not for me. That's group number two. And then there's group number three. Group number three is the group that knows about the scandals and cares about mm-hmm. the scandals. And it does seem to me, at least anecdotally, that group number three is growing by the week. You can see this not only sort of looking at a tiny segment of that world on my sort of Twitter feed or on my Facebook news feed, but also you can see growing momentum, I think, among news organizations covering what seems to be a burgeoning blowout.
Oh, my question about that is, and you hinted at it, with this, 2 billion users across the world are using Facebook. Do they care if a couple hundred thousand of them, or even a couple million of them in the United States, decide they're fed up?
This is the way that I think about it, and my thoughts here are evolving by the week and by the day as these scandals morph into new scandals or developing scandals. As I said, for the longest time, we've known if you're not paying for the product, you are the product, right? That's a cliche. It's so widely known. Nobody cared that they were the product when the product was Farmville, when the product was dating apps, when the product was weather apps. No one cared that they were the product. But right now, the product seems to be democracy. The product is a shared sense of reality in the Western world. The product might be, you know, the threats or accusations of a stolen election by Donald Trump. And once the stakes are that high, people care that they're the product.
And that is why we will keep talking to you about it. Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.